Podcast, the home of underground and progressive music. I'm Alex Hogg, and I'm joined, as every week, by Dave. Hello, Dave.
Hello. How you doing?
How's the
weather over there on the west coast of Australia today?
Surprisingly good, actually. It's been rather warm over here, even though we're in May and it's supposed to be winter, but, you know.
Well, it's been, we've had our first sort of break at winter, if you will, over the last few days, over the last little bit. And it's actually raining. It's been raining the last few days, and it's been raining most of the day, and there's actually been a little bit of sun that's come out from, I can see it from my apartment across the rooftops, and it's actually kind of nice.
Well, that's good. So, did you have any follow-up or things you wanted to talk about from our Marillion Extravaganza episode last time?
Do you know what? I didn't have anything specific I wanted to talk about, but I actually went back and listened to a couple of Marillion albums over the week.
Which one specifically?
So I re-listened to Brave. Yep. Because it's, I mean, fuck, it was awesome. And also re-listened to This Strange Engine again, because it was really my intro, I suppose, into it, that and Brave, and the Fear album,
yes,
which was which you brought up a couple of times. So I thought, you know what, I should probably have a listen, and I really liked it. Like, it was fun. It was just a good album.
I do particularly like that one as well. There is one track on there that I'm not a particularly big fan of, the Leavers.
Yes,
That's just a personal thing. I know that a lot of the fans really, really love that track. I don't. Mm-hmm. Don't all start sending me emails about it, because, yeah, I know. I've already had this out with many people already.
I feel that's going to become a constant theme for this podcast, you know, just people writing angry emails over
us
things that we say.
Us deflecting horrible feedback from fans, yeah. Especially if we start getting into, well, we'll try and avoid getting a little bit too much into the bashing of bands.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I think there's a few bands, though, that we can bash without any problems, and I think one of them is Metallica. You know, please don't sue us. I think anything in the pop sphere, I think we have the right to have free reign over.
Speaking of this pop sphere, I know that the single that Stephen Wilson released off his new album, a track called Permanating, yeah, that one hasn't gone down well. The fan base, well, because it's essentially Nearest Makes No Difference a pop song. Mm-hmm. It's very influenced by ABBA in the piano sound and the sort of 1970s disco hall drum beat. Mm-hmm. A lot of people haven't really warmed to that, me included.
Right.
And Stephen Wilson has made mention of this in concert. Like, he'll see people in Pink Floyd and King Crimson t-shirts sort of sitting there glaring at him during the song, but he says you can pretty well guarantee it that by the end of the song they're up and dancing with everybody else.
Proghead's are strange people, aren't they? I'm just going to grab a little bit here on YouTube of Permanating for those of us who haven't heard it, and just see if we can just play a little bit of this here. So this is the new single from Stephen Wilson, Permanating. Yeah, you can really hear the ABBA in that.
You get the idea. It's the piano and the way that the... Are you watching the film clip or are you just listening to it?
No, I was watching the film clip as well.
Did you get to the part with the Bollywood dancers yet?
Yes, I did. That's very very start. I just skipped up to about 30 seconds.
Yep.
And it is very strange.
Yes, it is.
It's a very weird film clip. But I actually don't... See, this is my concern. I think I said this a little while ago. With Porcupine Tree and Stephen Wilson and such, Stephen Wilson kind of for me feels like Porcupine Tree without the Porcupine Tree, and maybe this song is sort of going some way to you know, bolster that argument.
But I know he's always been talking about he wants to progress and do different things and not just sort of stand still and make the same record over and over and over again, which is a truly progressive ideal. And now he's sort of, I think it. It seems to me that a lot of progressive artists seem to trend towards wanting to write songs sooner or later. Look at you, Dream Theater.
not going to get any angry emails about that one.
Nope, not at all.
I tend to agree with you. I mean, if you look at Pink Floyd in their early days, you know, they were very much about concepts, and you know, I mean, you had the Animals album, obviously you had you know, The Wall, and
well, even before that, you just had a lot of sort of, as David Gilmour described it, psychedelic noodly stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and Echoes, a 25-minute track of which there's sort of a bit of singing, and then there's a lot of sort of spacey stuff in the middle of it. Mm, so you don't even necessarily have to, go right the way back to also, the sort of Sid Barrett days.
I know you could look at Shine On Your Crazy Diamond, which is a song about Sid Barrett and LSD. Copious amounts of LSD.
Sure about that.
Well, apparently the song, the reason it's called Shine On Your Crazy Diamond is because what Sid Barrett used to do, and maybe one of our fans can tell us whether or not this is correct, but what he used to do is actually get a sheet of LSD and melt it into his hair gel.
I think it was Mandrax or some other sort of tablet type thing, and melt it with candle wax and sort of pour it over his head. I have and then in the hot sort of lights and stuff of a gig,
it'll
start to melt and then go all over his face
and go into his scalp and things like that. Which was Hendrix did that as well with LSD. He actually used to put liquid LSD on his headband, so he was sweating throughout the performance, it would actually come down and he'd ingest it, and you know, he would make it a true Jimi Hendrix experience, at least for him. Mm-hmm. Which is an interesting concept, but I think getting back to the point of prog bands going towards songs, I tend to agree with you. I think they do tend to want to write songs later on, even if they turn out absolutely abysmal, like pretty much 99% of the Astonishing album, or if they turn out, you know, absolutely freaking amazing, like and I know that this isn't a bad example because it's an earlier example, but you know, Trains by Porcupine Tree is probably one of my favorite prog songs as just a standalone song.
Do you know what the fun part about Trains is? Stephen Wilson has openly acknowledged that a lot of the fans really, really like that song. It was just a song that he had. It wasn't necessarily something that was deliberately crafted or thought of as being this really sort of pop. And suddenly it all became just like, holy crap, you know, people actually love this. So you can never really tell what people are going to get behind.
This is true. I think this is true, and particularly in a sad way today, you know, a lot of music, a lot of bands and artists. Just, I mean, Eurovision was last night.
Let's not go there.
Which I watch it every year, right? Now I'm a big Eurovision fan.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing that pissed me off last night was not the fact that Israel won, although that was really annoying because their song was shit, but the guy who had the best track of the entire night, which I think was Finland from memory, the song itself was called That's How You Write a Song.
I did sort of vaguely hear it. I didn't watch Eurovision at all and frankly didn't even know it was on until I woke up on whatever it was Sunday morning and found, you know, 15,000 comments about it on my timeline. That's how I found out it was on.
I completely I'd ignored everything. I didn't want to see it because I wanted to see where we came, obviously Australia now being a part of Eurovision.
Go work that one out.
And I got right to the final bit where they got to the vote. There's two stages of voting. There's the jury vote, which comes from all the countries, and then there's a popular vote, which comes from obviously the people of the countries. And we got to that, and I'm sitting there with my roommate, and my roommate goes, man, it really sucks that we only got whatever the place was that we got. And I've just gone, thanks. And she's like, oh, didn't you know? I'm like, no, I didn't. Like, I've gone through the whole day, the whole fucking day.
Spoilers.
Oh, man, yeah.
That's another – I've had a Surprisingly, I've had a couple of surprisingly heated arguments on the internet about spoiler culture and all that sort of thing. And judging from what you're saying, I think we're on the opposite sides of this one. So we might just park that one.
I think there's a difference between spoilers. Like, I mean, you know, we're obviously now talking about this after the fact, after it has happened. You know, quite a fair way after it's happened, several hours. If it gets spoiled, it's annoying. But, I mean, it'd be kind of like saying, you know, the twist of The Sixth Sense is that, spoiler alert, Bruce Willis is dead. And it's like someone's going to be like, oh, you know, or, you know, Darth Vader is Luke's father. It's like, well, you've had, like, what is it, 40 years or something to watch that film. I think by now... You know,
you haven't been listening to the people I've been listening to. According to those, that's still a spoiler. Don't do it.
Yeah, but that's ridiculous.
Yeah,
that's like saying don't give people the answer to the maths question because it's a spoiler.
This is the whole problem I have with spoiler culture in general. I find it generally just
spoiling.
The point I was going is that, like, it sort of gets to the point that anything at all that wasn't in, okay, now I'm talking about movies here, but anything that wasn't in the movie trailer is a spoiler. Absolutely anything. And that, you being a journalist, man, that should really, really make you squirm. As it does for a lot of my film journal. I mean,
I think yes and no. I mean, yes, it is annoying when you have a spoiler done, particularly if it's a major plot twist or something like that that you reveal. But with the trailers, nature of trailers going down the path that they are going down now, everything's a fucking spoiler in the trailer anyway.
Yeah,
because like, they put all the good bits in the trailer.
Then it just becomes like a Markov chain in the movie where you're just sitting there going, oh, yep, saw that bit. We're still waiting for this one little thing. Okay, now we've hit that one. Bang, we're done.
Exactly. Yeah, your QED, I can walk out now.
Yep.
But yeah, so we've digressed somewhat.
Yes, we have.
But I think, you know what? You're talking about the internet, and we're talking about obviously the people on the internet, and I think along with that is the websites of the internet. What about? I mean, this is a very, very ham-fisted attempt to, you know, ram this back onto some sort of a semblance of a track, but you know, we were going to talk this week about streaming sites. And indeed, that's where I listened to these Marillion albums. Was through YouTube and things like that, places where you can find all these sorts of music goodness. What's your general overview? I mean, of streaming sites. I mean, I use Spotify quite a lot. I've got friends of mine that use Google Music.
Yeah, plenty of people I know that are in the Apple ecosystem also use Apple Music.
Yes.
Seems to be the popular one on that side.
Those poor souls.
Don't. That's another one we'll just leave alone. Speaking very personally, I tend to use streaming sites quite differently to a lot of people. I tend to use streaming sites for when a new album comes out. I'll listen to it a couple of times and then decide up my mind whether I want to buy it or not. Mm-hmm. Compare and contrast, my fiance works for an IT company where external media is banned from their place, so they can't bring in iPods or USBs or CDs or whatever. So she uses streaming sites almost exclusively just to listen to music at work, and that's how it is with that. So there's sort of two ways of how I think a lot of people do it. And then you've got others who take the artist's side when it comes to streaming, and that streaming is sort of one step, or sort of a very, very small step above piracy, and they refuse to use streaming because they believe it's just yet another way that the artist is getting it in the neck.
I can't remember what the actual statistic is, but it's something like you get 0.0001 of a cent or something for every Every stream that occurs on Spotify, right? I suppose it's a quantity over quality kind of approach to things, where you've got a lot of people, absolutely streaming everything, which is a problem for the little guys, and it's not a problem for the big guys. You know, your Taylor Swift's, your Ed Sheeran's, the new guy that wears a helmet and runs around the stage pretending to DJ, whomever that may be.
I just pulled up an article here, there's an article here from a particular artist. In an eight-month period, they had 1 million streams, mm-hmm. and the total revenue from those streams was just short of $5,000.
Yeah, wow.
So it's an average payout per stream of 0.004891 cents.
Yeah, wow.
So there's the... So it's a million people listen to their songs, and the revenue is just short of $5,000. That's rubbish.
Yeah, I was going to say that bodes obviously horrifically for any artist, a prog artist or someone that's a little bit more underground, because their music's not ever going to be anywhere near as popular as the arse shakers and the money makers of the music industry.
I like the turn of phrase. That's a good one.
Back in the old days, we're talking 10 years ago now, you used to have a 20 or – did they have the 160 gig iPods out at that point, 2008 maybe?
Yeah, that's when I bought mine.
Yeah. So, and you used to have all of your music on your device, and you used to be able to sort of take it with you, and that's not a problem. But nowadays I just stream everything. You know, there's no the audio quality is good enough, especially if you're streaming in, 320 VBR or 320 CBR. Even it doesn't matter too much in MP3 terms. You don't have that much of a loss of quality. So the quality argument's really gone out the window, unless you're talking CD or even vinyl quality, in which case it's a whole different kettle of fish. But so
or
far
some
as the
other,
actual,
whatever those crazy high remixes are doing now, I forget the name of the things. I'm not an audiophile and don't pretend to be one. Just as a side to it, with the quality thing, unless you're, I don't know, a professional audio engineer or something, I'd be very, very surprised if the average punter on the street is going to be able to pick one from the other.
Well, there was a thing done by
It's probably by Neil Young when he was working on the Pono, his music player, and he was trying to argue. We'll put this link in the show notes, but somebody did a test of the Pono. It didn't do very well.
Was this the one, the results where basically everyone was like, listener preference with headphones and earbuds didn't matter, the iPhone actually sounded better?
Yep, that's exactly right. The test
Which
subjects
when you consider
thought,
the DAX
thought, yeah.
and the actual everything that's in the iPhone, that's actually very depressing because it's terrible from an audio quality point. But it wasn't that. The thing that I saw was an actual test online where there were two samples of a song, and you could play it and you had to pick which one was the WAVE version and which one was the MP3 version. Or which one was the higher MP quality MP3 version over the lower quality or something like that. And I did it, having my background in music and music production and music journalism and so on and so forth. So I'm reasonably well-versed in this stuff. And I didn't get belted, but I certainly didn't score. I think I scored like 50%. Which it's possible.
It's no better than random chance, really.
But exactly. I mean, I could have, just picked it at random. And there are some where, once you get down to about 128 kbps, when you're talking for the tech heads in the audience, once you get into about 128, you start to get clipping on things like hi-hats and crash cymbals and all that. So you can hear it. It just gets a bit raspy. But if you're up 256, 320, it ain't going to make a difference, especially not for a party mix or for driving in your car or... if you're one of these people who's got a massive vinyl collection and you've got the tower speakers and you've just spent $3,000 on a turntable needle and then you've just spent $120,000 per side on a new pair of, some sort of amazing speakers that, make you lunch and all this sort of stuff. But yeah, bit of a different story. I got a friend of mine who lives in Perth, actually, who does that. He's the last speakers he bought were something like $55,000 a side.
Oh, God.
and
presumably those are the sorts of speakers that someone would use in an actual recording studio.
Well, no, these are listening speakers. So, you know, recording studio speakers and hi-fi speakers are two very different kettle of fish in that one, you want them to be as flat as possible, the recording one, so you can hear everything properly, whereas the other ones, you actually want it to sort of develop the sound a little bit further and sort of take on, you know, a bit of richness and so on and so forth, which is weird. I mean, it makes sense, but, you know, when you hear a proper flat pair of speakers, you sort of think everything just sounds terrible, and it does, but that's the point.
So I suppose then with the somewhat lousy royalty rates that artists are getting from these streaming sites, there's been a few different artists who've come up with different ways or different ideas on how to try and recoup some of those costs. One of those is King Crimson. If you go onto any of the streaming services, it doesn't matter which one, the only thing you're going to find is two live albums, one recorded in Chicago and one recorded in Vienna. That's it. That's all you've got to listen to. If you want to listen to anything else, you can go to their website, open your wallet and pay for it.
That's interesting because I've actually just pulled that up on Spotify as you're talking on my phone. And you're right. There's the Vienna one, which is the 1st of December.
2016,
yep. And then you had Live in Chicago, 28th of June, 2017. But there's also another one here, which is Radical Action to Unseat the Hold of the Monkey Mind, which is also live.
Ah, yes, that was the live one from the previous tour. I think that one was recorded in 2015. I do actually own a copy of that one, so I should know.
I mean, it's got the Court of the Crimson King and 21st Century Schizoid Man on it, so that's all I care about.
The live in Vienna one also has Fracture, which is unbelievably complicated. Apparently, they're not playing it. The King Crimson are about to tour in about a month's time.
Yeah, right.
And they're not playing that song on this tour specifically because, according to Robert Fripp, it took them more time to rehearse that one song than it did to rehearse anything else.
Wow. That's, yeah.
Mm, it's incredibly, an incredibly complicated track. So the other way that some artists have thought about or starting to build their own streaming services, I got an email because I'm a member of Neil Morse's Inner Circle fan club. He's trying to build his own. I'm not a particular, I mean, I'm not that technologically savvy, but it seems to me that that is a lot of work to try and build your own system to capture 100% of the revenue stream yourself. That seems like a lot of work. What do you think about that one? Do you think that could possibly, well, yeah, he might be able to build it and he might be able to put his own music on there. Do you think it's actually going to pay for itself and it can be any better than any of the other streaming services on offer?
I'm never going to say never with this sort of stuff, because if there's anything that I've learnt in my life is that when you say never, you always get proven wrong. But I think it's unlikely. You know, realistically, you've got three massive streaming services out there now. You've got Spotify, as we said before, Apple Music and Google Music as well. You know, Google Music subscriptions are starting to come with Google phones. The same thing with Apple phones. Spotify is still out there on its own.
The other thing I was going to say, yeah, you've got Amazon Music. That's certainly coming up. What I was going to say with subscriptions and stuff, I know when I took out a new telephone plan with Telstra, the phone provider that I use here in Australia, that came with an Apple Music subscription, which I quickly set on fire.
But that's, I think the reality is anyone coming into the market now, as with any market that you go into, you want to try and break into, you've got to be doing something very different to attract people's attention. And I think the unfortunate thing is this guy isn't exactly a calling card. You know, Neil Morse, you know, this could be a really good platform for prog artists, because if they are recouping a little bit more of the costs and they are getting paid a little bit more, then it's probably not a bad thing.
Yeah, it depends whether you can attract enough people across to it. I mean, it's always the way with internet. The internet always tries to build a monopoly. It always ends up building monopolies. I mean, look around. Who's competing with YouTube? Nobody. Who's competing with Amazon? Nobody.
Exactly.
There are very, very few. It tends to build monopolies or, you know, at the very least, duopolies. You've got Apple and you've got Android. So you've monopoly or at the very least a duopoly.
Yeah. Yeah. And competition is a great thing. The problem is whether or not competition is going to be able to do anything.
Yeah. I mean, if Neil Morse did decide to build it and then was able to demonstrate to artists, I can get you a better royalty rate if you exclusively post your music here, then maybe he might be able to entice a few people across.
Yeah, but you've got to have those people listening to it as well.
Exactly.
Which I just don't think. I mean, I don't know how many active users Spotify has at the moment, but I'm gonna guess it's a metric buttload. It has to be a lot.
Real time follow up here. According to an article in The Verge, Spotify now has 140 million active users.
Yeah. So not as many as I'd have thought.
No,
not gonna lie.
I would have thought. I mean, let's have a look. You know, this will be the big one. Apple Music. Apple Music. Oh, that's interesting. Ah, they've split it out. So Apple Music have 38 million paying subscribers.
Ah,
that's the qualifier. Spotify probably have, paying subscribers. Maybe not, but they've certainly got a lot of unpaid subscribers.
Yeah, I know that's actually probably a good point because Spotify is a German company, if I remember correctly. And I think there's laws in Germany pertaining to this kind of stuff. So active, I think the definition of an active user is someone who's paying for the use of it.
Yes. Just as a clarify as well, Spotify is Swedish. But
oh, they're Swedish, are they?
You're probably right. It's all sort of EU, EEA sort of thing, and there's all sorts of rules surrounding what you can and can't do over there. So
there you go.
There's probably something involved in that.
Yeah, yeah.
We also briefly touched on YouTube as a sort of, in broad quotes, streaming service.
Well, now they've got YouTube Red.
Yes. That's tend to be more towards sort of video content and stuff. You'll find actually, and this is a massive, massive problem in the industry, you'll find a lot of stuff, unless the artist has their own specific YouTube channel. I know Marillion has one where they post clips from various live DVDs and stuff. You go online and I guarantee you I could probably find 50 versions of the same song that is not hosted by Marillion. So we're talking just straight up copyright infringement, freebooting, whatever the word you want to call it. People freeboot the stuff and they will just upload it on their own channel and draw in the links.
It's a funny, I suppose, conundrum because, you know, back when, as I'm sure, when you were younger and when I was younger, we used to do tape swapping or CD swapping.
Oh, absolutely. Burning CDs and all that stuff.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I remember, you know, mates of mine used to come over with, you know, Sick Mix 1 and Sick Mix 2 and, you know, Sick Mix 2002 and all that sort of stuff. And the amount of music that I got off a lot of that, you know, I mean, my love for Weird Al Yankovic was born out of those sorts of CDs, and my love for, Seether and, the more sort of emo-y sorts of bands I used to listen to when I was, you know, 14, 15, 16, was all born out of that.
Oh, absolutely. And even now, I mean, I caught up with a friend of mine for dinner on Friday night and he handed me a USB with several albums in it. Hey, here's something you might like. You know,
exactly.
Some stuff in there, like Alt J. There was a couple of Sigur Rós albums on there that I haven't listened to yet.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. And so it still happens today even.
Yeah, and I think this is where some of the laws haven't quite caught up with, you know, just the mass, the sheer immensity of the internet. Is that people can upload whatever they want, wherever they want, however they want, essentially. You're never going to be able to shut down what is now called piracy or internet piracy because it's just so easy to access.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the – is it like – what's the – is it Hydra, the Greek – looking great. They sort of cut off the head of one snake and two more appear.
I suppose so. You're probably a bit more well versed in that one than I am. But it is that sort of a concept, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, how many times have the government tried to shut down Pirate Bay?
Yeah, and
how many times has that happened? And it just keeps coming back.
Have they done it? Have they? I think they finally did it recently, no, didn't they?
It's still there.
Okay, there you go. You know, I mean, in Australia, we've got internet filters now here, which stop us from getting onto particular things. And I mean, this is
which are pathetically easy to circumvent, I might add.
Yeah, I mean, you know, anyone who doesn't have a VPN at this point probably shouldn't be using the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and this is getting further into it as well. You go to things like Netflix or Spotify in different countries has different content. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I went and actually went and photographed the Story of the Year the other night. And for some reason, one of their albums is not available here in Australia. It's not on the Australian Spotify. The same with Taylor Swift's Red. It's not on the Australian Spotify. You can find it. You can actually find a playlist that some guy has made pointing to the whole album and use that way you can actually listen to it. But there is no Spotify official album in Australia for that.
Wow.
Which brings another, you know, thing to the mix here with streaming services, and that is why the hell do we have different streaming services or different content available in different countries?
Oh, God, yeah, geo-blocking, that, yeah, we could have a whole... I mean, this is a particularly sore point. For those of you around the world who are not natively or don't live in Australia or weren't born here, geo-blocking has been a massive, massive problem here for a long time, mm-hmm. to the point of where I could hop on a plane, fly to Los Angeles, buy a copy of Photoshop and fly home, and it's cheaper than me buying it here just because of straight up geo-blocking, this is me buying an online copy. It's the same file in the same server, but because we're here in Australia, we get charged more, and it's people just hate it.
Well, that's an example of another thing as well called the Australia tax, which is just mm-hmm. everything in this country is just obscenely expensive.
Because we're a giant island in the middle of nowhere full of spiders.
Well, yeah. and then you've got the people as well. But, I mean, you know, it's a fitting end for convicts, let's be honest. But I mean, it is a horrendously irritating thing here where we can't get, you know, particular TV shows. You jump on YouTube sometimes and on Reddit, it happens to me all the time. It shits me off the wall. You know, there's something really funny and it's got a whole bunch of upvotes and you go and you click on it and it says, oh, I'm sorry, the uploader hasn't made this available in your country.
Yeah.
It's like, what the fuck do you mean you haven't made it available in my country? It's on the internet.
Yeah. I mean, this is a particular problem with, some of the Saturday Night Live stuff. Like
Saturday Night Live stuff.
Without wanting to get too particularly political here, I really wanted to see the new Alec Baldwin, Donald Trump skit. And I went on YouTube, found it, found the link, clicked on the link. Nope, content blocked in this country due to rights claim by... insert giant multimedia company here that starts with N and ends with Us Corp.
and the irony of that is that particular company is Australian.
Yes.
Oh, well, was. Don't know if still is.
I have no idea.
I don't know. But, I mean, it's just obscene.
It is.
It is actually obscene.
It is.
You know, that's the whole point of a free and open internet. I mean, I know stacks of people that have got VPNs for this exact reason because, you know, they get Spotify stuff at different times around the world, or they get, you know, I've got a friend of mine who's got the American Netflix, and the amount of stuff that is on the American Netflix as opposed to the Australian Netflix is eye-watering.
Yeah, same with the UK one. I've got another friend of mine who mm-hmm. hacks into the UK one specifically to watch. I don't know what it is they're watching, but it's something that's only available on the UK one.
Yeah, can't and it doesn't it, make yeah. any sense. And, well, it does. The reason for it is because of the laws and the agreements that are struck within particular countries. But the reality is that just goes to show that the sheer idiocy behind some of these media laws now and how far behind the times they actually are.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, this can devolve into a whole other topic about, you know, whether certain giant media companies, again, starting with N and ending with News Corp, are deliberately hamstringing our internet speeds to hang on to their monopolies on various services.
Well, you know, what is interesting is that I'm not certain that this is factual, but if you look at YouTube videos that have got low watches, so, you know, I'm talking in the, you know, hundreds to thousands, and very low thousands, 2,000 or 3,000 views, they load astronomically slower than those that have got hundreds of thousands of views. Let's not get into that. But
now that we've managed to wander across the whole topic of sort of the internet and companies sort of destroying, that segues rather nicely to the ticket sites and the other way that artists can seem to be able to, well, they seem to make a lot more money this way than they do in sort of people buying records or, you know, any of these streaming services, is touring live.
Well, this is where... this is where it all bands always traditionally made their money, was off touring and selling merch and tickets and people being at their shows and, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Certainly it has been for the last 20 years or so. Before that, people would, before sort of a centralized mass media, you would tour to promote the record. Because you're actually making money off record sales, so you would go to the local, you know, this is off our, you know, Rush or whatever is touring Minnesota, you know, goes to Minnesota, and okay, this is our new record, it's called Fly By Night, and this is a track from it called Anthem. And then people would hear that and they go, hey, that's really, and they've got to buy the record. Nowadays, it's completely flipped around the other way. You make records so you have something to tour. But now you've got companies that are looking to get in the middle of that and cash in.
I remember many years ago I wrote an article on this, and it got reasonable notoriety around the interwebs. And it was around about the time when Mega Upload and File Sonic and all that sort of stuff got belted, because people were uploading... They were sharing, you know, copyright material through Mega Upload and through FileSonic and ShareBee and all those, you know, all those sharing sites, those what they call file locker sites. And I think from memory that the general gist of the way it works in the music industry was something like, you know, artist makes a work and then they get paid for work and then told by a large company that they can give him or her more money for said work. Company then loans them money to make more work. Company recoups all the money off backup artists to pay for their time spent with artists before artist sees any money. Artist goes down toilet because he/she hasn't eaten in a few months and repeat.
Yep.
And that's generally how... Unfortunately, it works nowadays in the music industry.
Oh, absolutely. I was just going to, with ticketing sites and stuff, I'm going to put a link in the show notes to a podcast by Freakonomics Radio from several months ago now called Why is the Live Event Ticket Market So Screwed Up? And goes into the economics of why that is. It's very good. I urge everyone to give it a listen.
Yeah, I mean the whole ticketing thing now is, I mean, you've got the 360 deal, which was born from Sony. I think it was Paramore was the first act to ever be signed onto this, you know, spawn of Satan himself, which basically took a percentage of absolutely everything that the bands do. So it's traditionally it was just, you know, the album sales and so on and so forth, and then anything the band made from touring was their own. Whereas nowadays it's absolutely everything. So, you know, that includes streams, it includes video watches, it includes, you know, merch sales, it includes, you know, anything that you purchase at a gig. And I don't know about you, Hoggy, but I actually prefer to stream all the music, and then I'll go to the show and I'll drop $300 at the show and buy a hoodie and a disc, the new album, and, you know, obviously the tickets, because ticket prices in this country suck.
Yeah.
I mean,
speaking of ticket prices sucking, I mean, I've just paid $150 to see Stephen Wilson in Sydney in a couple of months.
Yeah.
$150. Yeah,
and that's obscene. Like, yeah. Don't get me wrong, I like Stephen Wilson, right? I like Porcupine Tree as much as the next guy. But, I mean, $150 to see a guy, where's he playing? I'm guessing the Metro?
Yeah, he's playing at the Enmore.
So the Enmore Theatre, for those of you who are not from Sydney and or have not ever been to the Enmore Theatre, is about 1,000 people, I think, capacity.
Oh, is it? It's, is it that small?
It's small, man.
Oh boy,
look it up.
I've not been to the Enmore. I mean, it seems to me that they sort of rotate around a bit. I mean, I used to a lot of gigs were at Horden Pavilion, and then they went to Manning Bar, and now obviously the Enmore.
1,600.
Oh, okay, 1,600 people. That is surprisingly small.
Yeah, when you consider that the Palais Theatre, which is sort of its counterpart, I suppose, in Melbourne, is 2,896. Sydney Opera House is 5,738. And I'm fairly certain that the Horden Pavilion's about 5,000.
Yeah, I saw G3 at the Horden Pavilion. I can't remember how many people were there, but yeah, that sounds about right.
That's $150 a ticket at the Enmore. That's absurd.
Well, he's coming along with a full production and all the back, lights and backings and projections and all sorts of stuff. So I'd be very, very surprised if he's sort of, and this is the other thing about the touring and the ticket sites and stuff like that. They're charging $150. I'd be very, very surprised if he's actually making any money out of that at all, or a very, very little amount of money. It's not like, the Rolling Stones, for example, the promoter charging millions of, the band charging the promoter millions of dollars to come and play a show and he doesn't make any money.
Yeah, and I suppose this goes back to, people actually doing it for the love of the music as opposed to doing it, for the love of the money of the music.
In this day and age, frankly, if you're trying to do it for money, you're probably in the wrong game.
Especially in Australia, where we have little support for the arts. And, I mean, that's another kettle of fish anyway. But what shits me about ticketing sites nowadays is not so much the... I mean, okay, there's a few things I don't like about, your Ticketmaster and your Ticketek and all those sorts of guys. I mean, charging me for an e-ticket, that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. $14 or whatever it is just to send an email.
Is it really that much for some of those concerts?
Some concerts, yeah. When I got the tickets for McCartney last year, it was I'm pretty sure it was $14. But the thing that annoys me is that it's not $14, it's $14 a ticket.
Oh, God.
And it's like, mate, what the hell
do
you...
That's barbaric.
You've just made $42 off my back for doing nothing. And the other option is more expensive. It's like, oh, I'll send you, all right, well, we'll send you them via registered mail. It's like, I don't want it via registered mail. I just want it on my phone. Well, then you're going to pay $14. It's like,
And then the alternative is you can pay for a physical ticket to be sent to you, and then you can just roll the dice on whether Australia Post are ever going to give it to you or not.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
At the risk of having sounded like, there's the worst first world problems in the world, when I bought tickets to the Royal Albert Hall Marillion show last year, the tickets turned up 2 weeks after I left.
What?
Yeah. The tickets took so long to get here that the gig had already happened by the time I got them.
Oh, you're kidding me.
But then what you could do, because they obviously know lots of people fly in for these shows, you just turned up at the gig with your credit card and the little confirmation number, they reprint the tickets for you.
Yeah,
which defeats the purpose of sending the goddamn tickets out in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that just doesn't make any...
But there's no option to do that. You can't just say, look, don't send me anything. I'll turn up, pick them up myself.
Well, even now in Australia, they charge you for box office collection. It's like $8 a ticket.
Yeah, I suppose they still have to pay someone to be in the box office and collect the things, I suppose.
Please, they're paying them in there anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
Just as a point to the Royal Albert Hall, that Marillion show that I went to, that sold out in something like 15 minutes.
Yeah, wow.
Almost immediately there were tickets available on Viagogo and other places selling these tickets off at astronomically high prices. Some bloke... There was a post of it. I'll never be able to find it because it's in one of the forums. But there was they were charging. Like the ticket was, I think, £75 or something, and that the Viagogo were charging £150 in what they called administrative charges.
Administrative charges.
Yep.
For what?
Their own profit. Nothing
well,
else.
Yes.
Yeah, they're nothing else. That's what they do. They just collect an absurd percentage of everything. And that's just... See, I believe how it works, and this is described more accurately in the podcast I mentioned earlier, that there are people literally with bots, and they will come in and they will write a script with the bot to go in and buy a whole bunch of tickets.
Mm-hmm.
This is why various other artists, I believe Iron Maiden did this, I know Kate Bush did this with some gigs. What they did is they had, you've got a ticket, you have to turn up with the credit card you bought it with and your ID to try and get mm-hmm. around this sort of scalping and touts and whatever other fancy word you want to use for it. That's what they did, which is one way of combating it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one way of combating it. The other way of combating it is just, you know, people could just not be dickheads. Yeah. That'd work. I mean, it's never going to work because people are always dickheads. But it's actually really irritating with a lot of this. I know we had a lot of problems with Dream Theater last time they came back to it when they were in Australia last time, particularly with, I want to say it was the VIP meet and greet. Doohiget Majiget? Or was it the time before?
Which, what are you referring to? What, when the link was broken on their website?
Yeah, and then people were trying to buy them on Viagogo, and it was just...
This is why I was the one who set the post up to when the tickets went on sale. This is why I deliberately went to their website, copied the link, and put it in the post, and said, this is the link, buy from here.
Well, I mean, because if you do Google a lot of artists nowadays, I mean, it doesn't matter who it is, it's coming to Australia. Who's coming to Australia in the next little while, actually? Let's just do a test here.
No, Stephen Wilson's a good one to pick.
So if I just look up Stephen Wilson tickets.
The first link will probably be Viagogo. Oh, I've got StubHub, which is another one of these.
Yeah.
Particular websites. StubHub, yeah, exactly. Viagogo second, actually. And then the third link down is the official Ticketmaster link. Yeah.
So my top one is Viagogo. No. The next one underneath that is Viagogo. The one under that is The Music. And then the one after that is Ticketmaster.
The Music is probably the article about the tour.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so the Stephen Wilson.
The fact that I'm running
Australian
ad blockers on Google and it's got these things that still pop up anyway. It's just... I'm not going to click on these links because I refuse to drive them any traffic, so...
Well, yeah, don't blame you. I wouldn't be giving them any traffic either. The bastards. This is what, unfortunately, the music industry has come to, and now with, you know... I mean, the first episode we were talking about whether or not prog is making a comeback. If this is what is going to be out there for prog and prog music, and can you imagine trying to traipse up through this world now? Could you imagine...
Yeah.
Dream Theater or Rush or Yes or Genesis or, you know, even Metallica, Linkin Park, all those sorts of guys actually breaking through today in cacophony of noise.
And the other thing is as well, that to add to all this, back a few years ago, we're probably talking 20 years ago, an artist would be signed to a record label and given a few albums to sort of show this stuff. Now, it seems like the artists, the first record has to be a massive hit or you're out the door. Or worse still, is they release a few albums independently and then get signed with a massive record label. And then, so all of the sort of nurturing and arrangements and stuff that happen to get an artist to that level where they become a breakout hit, that's all have to be done independently. And then the record company just sort of waltzes in at the last minute and takes whatever they want.
That's right.
Yeah.
It must be frustrating. And this, you can understand why a lot of bands nowadays are doing a lot of production, even writing entire albums and such in their bedrooms. You know, and we've got a lot of great music out of that. I mean, you know, I don't know if you're a fan of Lord, but, you know, Royals by Lord was completely written in her bedroom. And she even used a pirated version of... of Pro Tools, and it came out like I don't know 6 months ago or something, and she said no, it's okay, we've bought it since then, it's all good. She went on to say, you know, but in New Zealand and Australia as well is sort of similar. the prices of things are just, it's prohibitive to create music and to create a lot of that sort of stuff. But, you know, you can go down the road and buy, you know, a self-help book to start, you know, your own business for $20 and then, you know, go and start, you know, mowing lawns. That's all good. But, you know, if you want to do anything in the arts, it's just hideously expensive to do anything to do with it.
Absolutely. And this is a whole other topic that we might shelve for another day. But this idea that art is now coming back towards how it used to be several hundred years ago, where art was almost exclusively created by rich people.
Yeah. There's a line actually in a Porcupine Tree song about that, which is, you know, the sound of music.
I know which one you're talking about.
What's he say? Music of rebellion makes you feel one at age, I think, but it's made of by millionaires who are three times your age or something like that.
I know the line you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know it is. It's exactly what's happening. Again,
absolutely.
You know, we've got these people who are basically telling us what we should be listening to.
Mm-hmm. And the people that can pay for to have it distributed, you know.
Yeah. You know what? You just sparked a memory in my head. Taylor Swift has done something recently. And you know, Taylor Swift, I'm a big Swiftie from way back. The thing she's got now where you can buy points to get ahead.
Oh, yeah, and the queue to, yes, I was trying to find
to
the
get
link.
Concert tickets
unfortunately,
and stuff.
The link I had to put in the show notes is actually dead. It's a dead link now, so I'm trying to find another one. But yeah, the idea that you've got, I think it had a name. Is it Fans? Let me see if I can find it.
But essentially the way it worked was, you know, if you buy the album, you get a certain amount of points. And if you buy a tour poster, you get a certain amount of points. And if you buy this, you get a certain amount of points. And if
tweet
you subscribe to
like
this and tweet about it and all that, and it actually gives you points so you can actually get to the front of the queue for Ticketmaster for sales.
Yep.
So you can actually get tickets prior to everyone else. That's just abhorrent.
It is. It's absolutely terrible.
That's paramount to sacrificing a child. I mean,
yeah. And of course, that's not open to exploitation at all. And
not at all.
And bots and things and being involved to just be able to write your way, you know, just sort of get your way around that one.
I mean, you imagine you put yourself in the shoes of some kid who lives in a trailer in the Midwest of the United States, which, you know, is a far more common thing than people would like to admit. And, you know, she looks up to Taylor Swift as a massive idol. You know, she wants to be like her. She wants to move to New York one day. She's got the dreams of all that sort of stuff, but she's never going to get a ticket because some smug prick from California is buying their equally smug child as they drive around in the four-wheel drive Porsche feeling smug and superior to everyone, 25 copies of the album so that they can get ahead of the queue of everyone else. That's just deplorable.
It is. It's absolutely terrible. I don't know how long that one's going to last. I can't see it lasting too much longer.
You say that.
But because because the system works and the record company's still generating the money and the tickets still get sold, who cares?
Well, it's not so much who cares, but I think, you know,
who cares from
that's
the perspective
gonna be
of the record company, I mean.
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's the really sad thing.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it's not bad enough now that we've got these ticket scalping sites. We've got, you know, servers that just go absolutely haywire whenever anyone of mild note comes to these shores here. I remember when I bought the tickets for Paul McCartney, I was on the site, I think, half an hour before they went on sale.
Yeah, I did the same thing when Roger Waters came to town. I did the same thing when Metallica came to town. The Metallica tickets back in 2010, they were gone in 10 minutes.
Yep, and it was the same. Paul McCartney, I think, was sold out in about 4 minutes or something like that. And then they put on a second show. But I got tickets to the first show for mum, dad, and myself, and it was absurd. You know, the fact that you have to do that is just...
But I suppose, you know, it's all good and well for us to complain about these things. I suppose the question that probably needs to be answered, and I don't know if we can actually answer, but what do you do? What's the solution? What's the alternative? Mm. How do we get it into a situation where the fans get the tickets to the show and it's not a sort of free-to-play, you know, sort of free-to-play who's got the most money wins? which everything seems to be. How would you potentially solve it?
You know what I'd really like to see? I'd like to see a return to tickets being sold at the gates. So you actually have to show up on the night to buy them.
Now, how's that any different though? Then you've got someone who can, some person who can, you know, potentially pay for a whole bunch of people to be in line for them.
Yeah, I mean, I get that and I understand that. But, well, the way what I would do is instead of having, you know, people paying for people to be in line for you, I don't necessarily see that that's necessarily a bad thing, because if you're paying for someone to be in line for you, okay, maybe someone else might miss out, you know, but you and your mates were probably going to go anyway. Whereas those people that were in line probably weren't going to make it, but
that's how old fashioned touting used to happen.
Would
have a whole button, he'd buy 20 tickets, and then he'd be able to, you know, sell them on the sly for massive profit.
That's how that happened. I suppose it would be nice to see. And there have been quite a few artists that have taken issue with this, even on stage. I know Adele did it when she was here, over ticket scalping and scalping prices and all that sort of stuff. I suppose the question is whether or not you can actually stop it. And yeah, maybe the best way is to, you know, have that credit card for you. But then that brings up problems where you can't gift anyone a pair of tickets now.
Yeah, there's a whole Q&A section on Iron Maiden's website about, oh, what happens if I can't go? What happens if my friend bought, like, one guy buys four tickets for him and his mates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or, and you end up in, and there's a couple of forums that I belong to, where people can't go to gigs for whatever reason, so they say, oh, you know, I've got a ticket and I'm going to sell it, all at face value, I might add. But I can't go because can't get a babysitter, whatever. So, and then they sell it full face value to somebody who can go.
Yeah.
And boy, there was a lot of that going for the Marillion, the Royal Albert Hall gig. Marillion, there were lots of people that did that.
So I think the answer is hoggy to any of that. I mean, there's no silver bullet. And realistically, it comes down to sort of what I said before, which is people could stop being dicks.
Yeah, which is not really a solution in the end of the day, unfortunately. Trying to get people to be if only things were solved simply by just getting everybody to be nicer to each other. You know, yeah. how much greater would the world be if that happened?
Heal the world. The industry is not a great industry to be a part of anymore, and it has become, and realistically it started with the Beatles, it became an industry instead of, you know, a pastime, but I mean it's everywhere, you know. Sport now is, you know, full of people who get paid way too much to do what they do. You know, anything in the world that was once deemed as, I mean, you got YouTube, you got people on YouTube now sitting there yakking away over people watch people play video games.
Twitch streaming.
And Twitch streaming and things like that. I mean, I understand Twitch streaming from a perspective of, you know, you're doing, for example, a speed run of something, and there are some really cool speed running things, you know, like AGDQ and SGDQ and all that sort of stuff, which raise money for charities, like cancer charities and all that sort of stuff. So they speed run games for like a week. And obviously those speed runners also have their own things, which they donate things to. And some people make money off that. And I kind of understand that, because there's a little bit of a skill behind that. But what I don't get are these people who get on YouTube and just yell and scream at the TV because they're trying something new in Grand Theft Auto, and then they start laughing and all these people watch them do it. I don't understand that. There's no skill involved there. There's no anyway, I'm sounding like a person that should be saying get off my lawn. But,
oh, I think that was always going to happen. Us ending up sounding like grumpy old men.
Yes, exactly. Get off my lawn.
anyway, so yeah. Sort of put that one, all the negativity and all the sort of complaining and whining to one side. Let's talk about something a little bit happier. I thought it would be good fun to just sort of have a very short, quick run through of some really, really great live concerts that we've both been to.
Yeah.
And sort of we could do this in a sort of reverse countdown. We've both got lists here in the show notes.
Yep.
So do you want to start? You want to start this one? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So I think my fifth best show that I've been to is probably when I saw Linkin Park on their Meteora tour. So,
in what now, I suspect will be a theme throughout this, I am very, very annoyed that I missed Linkin Park touring. I never saw them live.
I saw them, I think, three times. I saw them in 2004, back when Chester had his, you know, pink hair and mohawk. And then I saw them again in, when was it? 2000, when, it was when...
Minutes to Midnight album. So what, 2008, 2009 or something
no,
like that?
No, it wasn't Minutes to Midnight. It was the same year that U2 came. Actually, that might have been 2009. Could have been. Actually, you could be right. And then I saw them at Soundwave a few years later, 2013, I think, with the Perfect Circle and Metallica and all that sort of stuff. They played just before Metallica. Which was absolutely incredible. But I remember going to that because that was one of the first concerts I ever went to. Well, and obviously now with Chester being dead, unfortunately, having taken his own life, which is something that's very, very, very upsetting to talk about. And I should actually mention here as well, if anyone who's listening to this feels particularly you know, alone or you do need to talk to someone, Lifeline is an amazing Australian charity that does great work that you can call 13114, which I think needs to be said if we're talking about such a delicate circumstance. But, you know, I was watching the film clip, the last film clip that they released, which was One More Light, I think it's called, and it was done as a tribute to Chester.
Yep.
And I wasn't crying. You were crying. There's something in my eye.
Ninjas, you know, cutting onions.
Yeah, ninjas cutting onions. That's so I'm going to use that.
Feel for it.
But that's, you know, I mean, it was having seen Linkin Park a few times and actually having done that, and obviously with Chester leaving the world last year, I have to admit that that was an amazing concert, seeing them at what I deem their prime, which was, you know, 2004, back before they got all weird and poppy.
As I said, it is going to be a bit of a theme throughout this, is that you and I are going to be pissed off at each other that we have seen bands that the other one would really like to see.
Yep.
So the number five on my list is probably going to be Hans Zimmer, the famous film composer. He did a song. you missed that one, did you?
Nope, I didn't, but I know exactly. I mean, 10 points. Yeah, he wasn't in my list, but I... Yeah, cool.
Yep. So I actually missed the show when he came to Australia, but I did happen to see them about 6 months earlier while I was in Europe. I saw them
play.
I saw him play an arena in Sofia in Bulgaria. And that was an amazing show. I mean, I'm not a particularly big film soundtrack fan. It's it's certainly ones that I do really enjoy, and certainly some of his are on that list as well, but the band that he managed to assemble for this was amazing. I'm not sure if he did the same in Sydney, but he had the guy that originally did the song for The Lion King. He was at this show.
Wow,
sing.
Okay.
He had Guthrie Govan on guitar. He had an amazing band, and it was and I was sitting in like row 77 in the back of the stadium, but even back then, even back in that far in the stadium, it was still an amazing show. And for those of you who are interested, I've pulled out the set list for that particular show, and we can throw that in the show notes.
That would be actually something that would be amazing to see. Would be that set list, because I know he played a few things from the Inception soundtrack, Interstellar soundtrack.
Yep.
Which was basically the whole reason I went, because that was, I absolutely love, you know, it's basically Hans Zimmer leaning on an organ for 2 hours, and it's awesome.
I believe it was the same set list at every show. I don't think there was too much change, because, I mean, the amount of production that just go into arranging the thing and actually getting all the musicians rehearsed up, I don't think he could have sort of rotating set list every night with a show like that. I don't think he could do it.
Yeah, well, you're probably right. Yeah, and that's just, I mean, a lot of bands and artists do that nowadays anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So what's number four on your list?
Number four for me was going back 2008, 2009, somewhere around there, was actually the fourth or the third time that I saw John Fogerty. Now, ooh, for those who are listening who don't know who John Fogerty is, he's otherwise known as the voice and the brains behind Creedence Clearwater Revival, old swamp rock band from the 60s. And my dad's a massive Fogerty head, a massive Fogerty fan. And I saw him – the first time I saw him was when I was 8 on the Premonition tour. And then I saw him again in 2003 for the long – I think it was called The Long Road Home, and then Revival, which was – it was Revival, which was 2009, and then again more recently for the Wrote a Song for Everyone tour. But the Revival tour was awesome. It was really good, mostly because I went with my dad and we sat front row. And to see him sitting front row to someone, he's seen him every single time he's been here, and I've seen him every single time he's been here that I've been alive.
I didn't realize he toured that often here. How often?
Yeah. He's been here a total of 5 times.
Wow.
And the first time was with Creedence, obviously, back in 73 or 72 or something. And my dad was at that show. It was at, I think, Randwick Racecourse. So it was, Fogerty. There's actually a bit of controversy around that because it was deemed that – well, not deemed, but there's – people who went seemed to remember a rhythm guitarist playing, but there was no rhythm guitarist in the band at that point because Tom, his brother, had left. They had a bit of a falling out and they left.
Behind the curtain.
Yeah, either behind the curtain or, over the speakers with a tape. But it was – so Dad's seen him every single time he's been here, and I have to admit every single time I see him I am – blown away because he just gets better with age. He's like a fine wine or a cheese.
So I suppose the fun question that I have to ask with this concert, was he playing any CCR songs? Because
Absolutely.
Oh, okay. Because I know he went through a whole phase there where there was a lot of problems with him playing CCR songs because he didn't actually own the rights to them. And then the rights holder tried to sue him for a song that he wrote that sounded suspiciously similar to a song he'd already written. So
And how he actually defeated that in court, there's a whole write-up about it on the internet. He brought his guitar into court and played the new song. And his defense was, look, once you get stuck into a style that you are somewhat well known for and it's your thing, most songs are going to have similar characteristics to it. So, of course, it's going to sound similar.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's right. He's completely right. You look at any band, you can, generally speaking, you can close your eyes and hear who it is that's playing or who they're, at least, at the very least, who their main influence is from. And he's from an era where, influence, he was the influencer, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm sure he's by a lot of folk and stuff like that,
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but he had, these great big amplifiers that you turned up and they distorted and things like that, and it was very, very different to stuff nowadays. But I think that's number four for me was Fogerty on the Revival tour.
Nice.
Who's your number four?
So number four for me is going to be a slightly obscure one that I suspect very, very few people have ever heard of, but it's a local band, Tangled Thoughts of Leaving. Are you familiar with Tangled Thoughts of Leaving?
No. I mean, maybe in the morning after, but, not the band, no. So.
Nice. So Tangled Thoughts of Leaving, I would say, is probably the best Australian post-metal band going around these days.
Big call.
Why? Who would you nail to the mast on that one?
Or Sleep Makes Waves?
Those two have played a lot of shows together. This is probably going to come up with the inherent bias of me being on the West Coast and you being on the East Coast. Sleep Makes Waves being a Sydney-based band, Tangled Thoughts of Leaving being based in Perth.
Yeah, that's true. But that's okay. It's,
So they were touring Europe for the very, very first time. And before they left, they announced on Facebook 3 hours before the show that they were playing a secret gig at an old nightclub that doesn't exist anymore here called Yaya's.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to be in Perth that day and I was like, ooh, yes. Bought a ticket. And they played for 3.5 hours.
Wow.
pretty much ran through almost everything that they'd ever written at that point. And a whole bunch of just, they do a lot of jamming on stage, and there's a lot of stuff that is mostly improvised. A lot of these, I think all four of these guys have got a jazz based background. I believe all of them West Australian Academy of Performing Arts graduates, and consequently are phenomenal musicians. So a lot of stuff was improvised, and I couldn't find a set list for this gig because I suspect there wasn't one. And it was sort of almost like a tour fund. It was like a fundraiser for them to go off to Europe. So that's number four for me.
I'm just going to play a little bit of Tangled Thoughts of Leaving. I just jumped on YouTube and found Throw Us to the Wind and Sever Us from the Present. I don't know if this is one of the big ones. I don't know these guys. So I'm just going to play a little bit for the guys here who are listening. So this is Tangled Thoughts of Leaving, Throw Us to the Wind and Sever Us from the Present. You can easily hear, obviously all those influences that you were talking about. Which, you know, if you've ever done any formal music training, you understand you're either a classical person or you're a jazz person, or you're wrong. So you know, and that's generally speaking how it's noted.
Yeah,
so.
These guys are definitely there's definitely a lot of jazz influence. If I had to pick a song that. My personal favorite, I would probably pick one. You've picked a song off the first album. They did a couple of sort of independent or sort of EPs. That was you've picked one off their first studio album. What was their first? Dead in the Fields, sorry. Dead in the Fields. I personally prefer a song off the second album, which is called The Albanian Sleepover.
Right, okay.
Which is when they did the vinyl version, it took up an entire vinyl, but on the CD it's in two parts. That one's my favourite. So we can put a link to a few of those in the show notes.
Yeah, definitely. Let's put some Spotify links in there.
Probably won't find it on Spotify. Bandcamp is the place I tend to. And they're about to announce a pre-order for their latest album, which is due out sometime very shortly. So
yeah, well, let's definitely do that then. Try and get these people all sorted.
Absolutely.
So what are we up to? Number three.
Number three. Your number three.
My number three probably doesn't come as a surprise to those who know me, although maybe it will be a surprise that it was only third on the list. Tool. Big Day Out, 2011.
I would have thought you would have put that at number one.
No. There's two others that I think it should be noted that, you know, when you're talking to guys like myself and yourself, Hoggy, and I'm not, you know, blowing trumpets or anything here, but we see a lot of music and we go to a lot of gigs. So it's really, when you're talking the top five, there's such a slim margin between these.
Absolutely.
But Big Day Out, it was the first time I saw Tool, and they were supported by many, 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 many artists. Obviously, Big Day Out was a big music festival that we have here in Australia before it went to shit. And that was really the last great year that it was actually good, because the two headliners were Tool and Rammstein. And Rammstein were awesome, and Tool wiped the floor with them, in my opinion.
Oh, wow. Because, I mean, I'm not a particularly big fan of Rammstein's music per se. But you got to give it up that these guys do pull out all the stops live. Lots of pyrotechnics and funny props and people in cauldrons and giant plastic penises and all sorts of all the other fun things that go on in a Rammstein show. Which I think they kind of have to do anyway, because they're singing mostly, there are a couple of songs in English, but most of it's in German. So
Yeah, and it's pretty,
99%
most
of
it's
the stuff.
Pretty dark too. Like, it's pretty brutal stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, but I remember hearing a story that the one of the guitarists, I can't remember which one it was, actually got stopped at the border in Australia when they got to Brisbane, because they flew into Brisbane, and their bags got searched. And if you've ever seen Rammstein live, you know that one of the guitarists wears an SS uniform.
Oh.
So they looked at it and went,
WTF,
basically. And he had to explain to them who he was. And it turned out that the supervisor on shift was a massive fan and said, yeah, it's fine. You guys just go. I'm seeing you tomorrow at the big day out. So you guys do your thing, or a couple of days, a big day out or whatever it was. So
what an incredible self-serving statement.
Yeah.
I'm coming to see you guys, and I happen to be the ones who
So you got some passes for me, or but yeah, so no, Tool, Big Day Out 2011 was absolutely mind-blowing, mostly because they played every single song I wanted to hear. It was one of those gigs where I just checked everything off. There was nothing they could have played that could have been better. The set list itself was absolutely amazing for this gig. It was one of those gigs where you literally check everything off. So they started with Third Eye, but the version from Salival.
Ooh.
So the live version, not the weird one. And then they did Jambi, Vicarious, Eon Blue Apocalypse, The Patient, Intolerant, Schism, Lateralis, Anima, and then The Pot.
That's just damn good set list.
That was a huge set list. And then when I saw them again a few years later, they didn't play The Pot. They played a whole bunch of other stuff as well. But that was just, yeah, for me, number three, Tool, Big Day Out 2011. How about you? Number three.
So my number three, and we've been recording for an hour and a half at the moment, and I can't believe it's taken this long for me to mention Marillion. So, I mean, there are many Marillion gigs that I've been to, well, not as many as some, but there are many that could go into this spot, but the one I'm going to pick is the very first fan convention I went to in 2015 at Port Zealand, and specifically I'm picking the Sunday night. So on that Sunday night, it was a themed set list, and this particular night was all of the singles that they'd, well, almost all of them, almost all of the singles the band had ever released. So they kicked it off with several old favourites that don't get played very much anymore, Market Square Heroes and Garden Party, and the whole place went nuts when this went off, because the band had kept it pretty quiet about what they were playing on Sunday nights, and nobody really knew.
Yeah, wow.
So they played a whole lot of singles, and because it's in chronological order, it started with a lot of the big hits, a lot of the old stuff. So Market Square Heroes, Garden Party, Kaylee, Lavender, Heart of Lothian, which they sort of played medley, and then they just ran through all the singles, which was an amazing show. And the way that they did it, yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, that would have been, yeah, wow. Okay.
There's a live DVD. They filmed this particular concert, so there is a live DVD that exists of that if people want to check that one out.
Yeah, I think most people would. Is there a place you can buy it? Or?
Oh, yeah, you can buy it from their website at marillion.com.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that – I'm actually kind of surprised that Marillion's only at number three.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Okay. Right. I'm keen to see the top two. So for me, I think number two for me, Paul McCartney.
Yeah, needs no introduction. None at all.
I mean, it's, you know, he opened with A Hard Day's Night with that chord that no one seems to be able to figure out. And the place was on its feet. There were people ranging from, you know, there were people who were my folks' age, my folks are early 60s, people who were 70 there. I mean, anyone who was anyone in the music industry was there. I ran into, you know, guys from Channel 9. I ran into guys from, you know, many different recording studios and recording labels and things like that, and pretty big producers and representers and all that sort of representers, managers is the word I was looking for, that was there. But, you know, you had all these people from, you know, 75, and I think the youngest guy that I saw was like 8 years old, and he was on his father's shoulders behind me.
And so, that's the sort of stuff that makes live concerts so much fun.
Absolutely. And it was great. It was really, really good. I could not – and this was – I walked out of that going, no one's going to top this, and then someone did. So I'll leave it at that. Who's your number two?
I agonized a bit over who to put at number two, this one or the next one, but this is probably the one that I think is going to just annoy a lot of people that I was at. So my number two is Rush in Los Angeles, the last ever show that they ever performed.
Yeah, wow.
So my backstory with Rush is that me and a good friend of mine, Dean, had been speaking for three entire world tours about we should go and see Rush live. We should go and see Rush live. We should go and see Rush live. So this one, we heard that it was probably going to be the last one, turned out to be the last one. And I just told him, I said, I don't care what you have to do, who you have to bribe, whatever, we're going. And by pure coincidence, the only show that synchronized up with some breaks that I had professionally with my working life just so happened to be the last show of the tour, which was in Los Angeles at the Forum in Inglewood. So we flew all the way over there. I didn't see a lot of these people, but they were all the same sort of thing. It's LA, anybody who's anybody was there. So I'm led to believe Stuart Copeland was in attendance at this gig. Chad Smith was there. The guy from the Trailer Park Boys, Mike Smith, he was there. We actually met him after the gig. The coup de grace, we also met Alex Lifeson after the show as well, got a signed record and a photo with him as well.
Beautiful.
So that was a big one. And there were, I mean, there's a whole, there's a DVD that Rush released sometime after the show, Time Stands Still. And there were a lot of people who were very, I didn't see this necessarily because I was a long, long way. I wasn't particularly close. The tickets on their own cost $500 for the show, I might add. So I was quite aware, but there were a lot of people who were there that I saw on this DVD who were very emotional about this because they had seen them several hundred times before. Mm-hmm. For me, this was my very first Rush show. I've heard bands talk about this where they say, oh, we always try and play every show because no matter where we are, there's always someone who it's their very first time seeing it. Mm-hmm. And that was even true with Rush even after the very last one.
Yeah, there you go.
So that's my number two. Before we get to number one, do you want to do the worst one first, and then
I think we should do some honourable mentions as well. Do the honourable mentions and then the worst one.
Okay.
So honourable mention, I think the biggest honourable mention that I have to stress here is Dream Theatre. Their first Australian tour, their first Sydney show. I'd actually come back from. Yeah, some people might remember from last week when we were talking about this. I actually had to go to my grandfather's funeral, which was on – he died and it was scheduled on the same day, January 30, and I went, well, shit. So I ended up getting on a train from Newcastle, which for those of us who are geographically impaired and or don't know Australia, which is – probably most people. It's about 2 hours north by car. It was about 2.5 hour train trip. And then I ran from Central, which I think we worked out was about 35 minutes or something like that last speaking.
Yep.
So honourable mention to Dream Theatre. And you didn't come in far behind Linkin Park and Tool and McCartney and Fogarty and my number one, I have to admit. But those guys just stuck in my memory far more. There's some of the others as well. I mean, Billy Thorpe.
Billy Thorpe and the Aztecs.
Yeah, Billy Thorpe. Billy Thorpe, another honourable mention from my concert days. And some probably things that some people are going to look at me a bit weird and go, really? Nickelback, honourable mention.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah, actually, I have to admit, like, people like to give Nickelback shit, right? So do I. I mean, yep. You know, it's the paddle pop lion. Who doesn't? But they put on one hell of a show, and it's really memorable for me because I was standing in the pit, and in front of me there was a mum, dad, and 13-year-old girl, and they opened the night with Something in Your Mouth, which is one of their songs. And I'm sure for those of you who are listening to this who are of age, you can understand what that Something in Your Mouth is in terms of the song. All right, so the chorus goes, because it's so much better when you never pull it out because you look so much cuter with something in your mouth. The nice. Dad picked up the 13-year-old girl and proceeded to walk out. And it was hilarious. So I remember that vividly. And there were, I mean, there's a few, so many U2. I mean, far out, phenomenal concert.
Yeah, that one's still on the list for me.
You know, smaller bands as well. Carnival, Dead Letter Circus, Muse. You know, all of these are all honourable mentions. How about you? What are your honourable mentions?
Well, I was going to put Carnival was going to be one because I managed to, and again with Tangled Thoughts of Leaving were opening for Carnival at the Rosemount Hotel here in Perth, and I managed to get free tickets to that one.
Yeah, so, that would have been the same tour where Sleep Makes Waves supported them in Sydney.
Probably, yeah. There was lots of live different. Honourable mention that I was going to call out was Devin Townsend. Playing in the Plovdiv Amphitheatre in Bulgaria, which is only recently, mm-hmm. This was just September last year, playing with an orchestra.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
And he did all of Ocean Machine. He did a series of fan favourites, something that had been picked on the internet, with the orchestra, and then did Ocean Machine all the way through.
Oh, wow.
So first set with the orchestra, second set. Him on his own, or the band on their own without the orchestra doing Ocean Machine. So there's an honourable mention for me. Again, Marillion at the Royal Albert Hall. That was the other one I was going to pick terms of instead of the Port Ceylon Convention night, Marillion at the Royal Albert Hall. There were people from absolutely goddamn everywhere for that show. People who'd flown in from the West Coast of America. People who'd flown, like me, who flew in from Australia. There were quite a few Australians at that gig, actually. Wow. So it was really an event, and that was much lobbying by the band, or by the band and by the fans to get them to play the Royal Albert Hall, which they finally did.
What about your worst gig? What was your worst gig?
I've got two that I'm going to... the first one that I'm going to mention, not because they were particularly bad, I just found the gig to be really boring, which is Mono. I saw them in Sydney.
Yeah. Yeah,
at the old Newtown Social Club. I particularly like Mono's albums, the albums. Live, it was boring and remains one of only two gigs I've ever walked out of in my life.
Wow. Okay.
This one, that was one. So the second one, during some different times in my professional career, I was writing for a magazine. The very first gig I ever reviewed was a series of local bands. And the last act of the night was something that they referred to as Electric Toad. The reason I'm going into more detail about this is this particular band doesn't exist anymore, so I can say what I like. So what it was essentially all the musicians of the night on stage together in what I described in my review as a self-indulgent mess. Wow. They didn't take too particularly kindly to this, and you're going to have to put a beep in here, Dave. Call me a cunt on their Facebook page.
Yeah, that'll do it. Yep.
Which... made me laugh, made my editor laugh. It was, yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was in a small club, and there were three drummers, about nine guitarists, two keyboardists, and several bass players on stage, and it was just an awful mess. Wow. I've never seen anybody manage to pull off that many instruments on stage at once and actually sound half decent. Even G3 has struggled at times when you've got the three guitarists all doing the widdly widdly bits all in the same register. It sounds like a bit of a mess. Those are the worst ones for me. So what about you? Worst gig ever.
The worst gig that I have ever been to, hands down, was Ginger Safari at the Metro Theatre on the 11th of the 11th of the 11th. I distinctly remember it, partly because of the date, but because it is the only mosh pit I have ever gotten out of.
Oh, really? That bad?
Yep. Well, I went and saw a black metal band when I was 13.
Oh, wow.
I've seen people get heels in faces. I've been in the chili bowl. I've been in, you know, the middle of the pit for break stuff, you know, and I have never experienced anything quite as crushing or as just awful as I had at the in the Ginger Safari mosh pit.
And they're not even a metal band, are they? They're quite.
They're not. They're like, it's basically, I don't know if you ever played the game Little Big Planet, but the Safari Zone in Little Big Planet is basically the music for the Safari Zone.
Oh, okay.
And don't get me wrong, they were really good showmans and so on and so forth. And, you know, I think I wrote the review about it. I think from memory, I actually said I'm going to give it 2 scores, one for the pretentious phallic objects in the pit and one for the band itself. As a metalhead, you know, you understand the concept of when someone falls down in a pit, you pick them up.
Oh, absolutely. Right?
They didn't get that. They were mostly 16-year-old rednecks, what we would call bogans, but rednecks, drunk, pushing people around. I almost got into two fights, just
really, really lousy gig etiquette.
Oh man, and not to mention the security doing sweet FA. I mean, you know, there was the support acts from memory was Elizabeth Rose. Who was pretty good, Pluto Jean's and Megastick Fanfare. From memory, Megastick Fanfare were shit. Ginger Safari were really good, though. I think they take the cake for the worst one, but there is one other one that I do want to mention. Port act for a band called A Sound Mind, who are now known as Copia. They're reasonably big over in Europe, Australian, from Melbourne, I think, from memory. And essentially, what happened was their support act, who was on first, came on and for sound check decided that they were going to play, I think it was Lateralis by Tool, or no, it was 46 and 2. It's 46 and 2 by Tool.
That's brave.
And it was absolutely atrocious. And then I actually wrote that in the review, and I actually left the venue for their set because I just couldn't be bothered dealing with terrible, terrible musos. I came back and I wrote that in the review. Anyway, I got abused like you wouldn't – well, you probably would believe it, but I got abused like you wouldn't believe. I got death threats. I got people saying they were going to come to my house and fuck me up.
Oh, lovely.
I got everything under the sun that was imaginable. I basically got told that was what was going to happen. So I think that was that. Those two were probably my worst, I think. So number one, what's your number one, Hoggy? What's your number one?
My number one, I'm going to pick.
Please.
Yeah. I'm going to pick King Crimson. When I went to see them in Wrocław, I apologize to all the Polish fans if I pronounce that particular town's name wrong. Polish is a particularly difficult language to try and wrap my head around. And specifically, I'm going to pick the second night that I saw them, because they played 2 nights, one after the other. And specifically, I'm going to pick the second night, chief among which because they hit us with a cover of David Bowie's Heroes out of absolutely nowhere.
Oh, that would have been good.
Yes, it was. If you go to, we were speaking earlier about the live albums by King Crimson, both of those two live albums, the one in Vienna and the one in Chicago, both have versions of Heroes on those recordings. I described this show after I came out of the venue as like having the top of my head blown off. The musicianship and the level that those guys are operating on, it is unbelievable. If anybody out there, if King Crimson are coming even vaguely anywhere near you, I believe they're coming to Japan later this year. That's probably the closest they'll ever get to Australia. Buy tickets. Just go. There's a reason why I'm flying back to Poland later next month. This particular show, there were 8 of them on stage, including 3, including 3 drummers, which...
Jesus.
Yep. And, you know, Mel Collins, who plays saxophone and flute, Tony Levin on bass, Jacko, I can't pronounce Jacko's last name. I'm sorry, Jacko. He's on guitar and vocals. And then, of course, Robert Fripp with his guitar stylings. That's my number one.
So my number one probably doesn't come as a surprise to many people who know me well. But I did mention that there was one after seeing McCartney, I said there's no one's going to top this, but someone did, and that was Roger Waters.
Roger Waters
absolutely blew my mind. My folks who were with me, when we walked out of there, Dad said to me, he said, you know, I haven't seen you smile like that for years.
So I have to ask, which Roger Waters concert? Is this the one where he played The Wall all the way through, or is this the one where he was most recently here?
His most recent Us and Them tour.
Yes.
Because I actually went to The Wall, and I went to the Dark Side of the Moon ones as well.
Yeah, I only went to the one with The Wall. So that's my favorite.
The Wall was amazing, but I'd kind of seen it before because I'd seen DVDs of it and so on and so forth. Whereas this one, I actually went out of my way not to watch anything. So it floored me. Because he did all of Dark Side of the Moon, and then he did other bits and bobs from. He did Pigs and Dogs. And, you know, I mean, it was very political. It was very anti-Trump, which was awesome.
Again, you're not going to – I actually had a friend of mine who saw the same show, him playing in New York, of course, the home of Donald Trump. And there were a lot of very, shall we say, unhappy fans, like guys just sort of sitting there with both middle fingers in the air.
Yes, I think I've seen that video. That one, there was one in Texas as well where people were booing him.
Probably. That it's kind of quite. And then people were sort of saying, oh, just shut up and play the music. Well, at no point during the show does he go off on some rant about Donald. He doesn't do any of that, unlike certain other musicians who get politically active. Looking at you, Dave Mustaine. Ted Nugent, I'm looking at you.
So many people.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I just absolutely blew my mind. And I walked away from that concert going, yeah, this is like there's only one band left on my I have to see them list and I'm never going to see them. So, you know, it's kind of 6-1.
Yeah.
But yeah. I think they might be able to top it off. They might be able to knock Roger Waters off the top of the podium.
Well, I think we talked about this last week. You were talking about Led Zeppelin, aren't you?
Yep, Led Zeppelin. I think if they ever came to Australia, it would be a case of shut up and take my money.
Yep.
And however many of my limbs and organs you need.
Yep. Rob a bank, sell off whatever you need to sell off to, you know, make the money for that one. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But it would be, I think it would just be, I mean, that would be incredible. But, I mean, for me, Roger Waters was just the pinnacle. And for my dad to say to me, I haven't seen you that happy for a long time, I think that speaks volumes. So
I had a similar that same sort of feeling as well. Both myself and my fiance had when we saw King Crimson. And she was the one, before we actually got together as such, she was the one who press-ganged me into coming along to King Crimson because she'd seen them play in Utrecht the year before. And she had the similar sort of feeling as like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And when they announced the next round of European shows 2 years later, it's like, we're going. And then that's that. So I think that about wraps it up for tonight.
I think it does. I think next week we need to talk about those albums. So I think we should give each other some more albums for this coming week that we need to listen to. And readers and readers, listeners, if you've got anything that you want to sort of, you know, recommend, by all means, please do. What have you got for me, Alex? What's the next thing I should be listening to?
We've spoken already about Tangled Thoughts of Leaving. I will recommend that you listen to Tangled Thoughts of Leaving.
Yep.
And I'm going to pick their most recent album, which is from 2015, called Yield to Despair. We'll put a link in the show notes to their Bandcamp page where you can buy this from. Of those, that one is probably my personal favorite. So let's go with that. Tangled Thoughts of Leaving, Yield to Despair from 2015. What about you, Dave? What have you got for me?
I'm going to hit you with something a little bit out of kilter, I suppose, for this one. This is not a prog album. So,
ooh.
All right. So there was an album, I think it was released in 2008 from memory, a group called Above and Beyond. They're actually touring Australia very soon. I've got tickets. They're from England. They're from England. And they are the easiest way you can describe them is sort of like their deep house.
They describe themselves as electronic music. This will be an interesting one because generally speaking, I don't like electronic music, but I'm happy to give it a listen.
This is very different. These guys actually, the way they write songs, they're all actually music, like proper classically trained musos, right? So they approach it like a symphony.
Ah, okay. That sounds like the same thing. So which one
listen
you
to it? It's very different too. And they've got a new album out as well, which I don't think was as good as Group Therapy, but it's an amazing album, and definitely give it a spin. Tell me next week I'm wrong.
Group Therapy is the one you're suggesting? Okay. Oh, that'll be an interesting one to get onto.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thanks very much for everyone putting up with us again for another episode of the 9-8 podcast. My name is Dave.
And I'm Alex, and we will see you again next week.
See you again next week.
Adios.